And what I want to say is life is difficult, and so let's talk a little bit about the various types of adversities that we might be experiencing. In fact, Buddha, who that you're familiar with his writings, are the writings of the Buddha, life is suffering, one of the first of four noble truths by the Buddha. And the New Testament says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into various trials, because the working of trials worketh patience in your life. So there's nothing in the New Testament that suggests that as Christians, we're going to be immune from suffering. You know, I sometimes listen, I was listening not long ago to one of the televangelists, and he was like saying, you know, Christianity is a road to prosperity. Well, not necessarily. All I sensed was in the New Testament that Jesus said that we give us this day our daily bread. He didn't say we were going to be a millionaire about being a Christian. Some Christians are blessed with a considerable amount of wealth, but some aren't. And certainly when you read the accounts of the first century, you don't get the idea that those people were very rich. They were rich in other ways, but Christianity is not a road to immediate riches. It's not a road to a complete immunity from suffering. You're going to experience suffering in terms of our difficulties of life. So there are different types of adversity. Well, let's talk a little bit about what those are. And in this case, I'm going to give a personal illustration. October 23rd, 1993, LaCreed and I had waked up in our house, and we had a knock on the door. And a deputy sheriff was there to tell us that our son Adam had been killed. What had happened was that he had gone to a party the night before. In fact, he'd called me and said, I'll see you in church on Sunday. I said, I'm going to a party, Dad. And unfortunately, the host of the party had a number of guns, and he brought one out to display, and the gun went off and killed our son instantly. So this is a picture of Adam. He had just graduated from law school at age 27. He had a great career in front of him, and suddenly he was gone. So we, of course, were devastated. In fact, I remember the very day that a minister came to our house, and I looked at him and I said, George, how will I ever get over this? And he was very truthful. He said, you won't get over it. He said, you will limp, but he said, you can go through life with a limp. And there was something about that that encouraged me, because I didn't even know whether I could go on, but he was saying, yes, you'll carry that pain with you, but you can go ahead and survive and move forward. And I'm sure that a lot of people in this room could talk about the same thing. Some have lost a spouse. Man loses his wife, or a woman loses a husband. We haven't experienced that, but I know some of you have, and we understand it's probable in our own life that one of us will precede the other in death. And so you have the loss of a loved one that you have to confront. Or perhaps you have a chronic illness. Our daughter, for instance, or my sister, I meant to say, at age 39, was diagnosed with diabetes. It was type 1 diabetes, meant that she had to take a shot the rest of her life. And she was thin. I assume that maybe it was something genetic. But she's had that chronic illness, and she's just a year younger than I am, and has lived with it. You perhaps have experienced something like cancer or Parkinson's disease or heart trouble. The list could go on and on. So sometime, that's what we're called upon to experience. Sometimes we have difficulties with our children. When I served in the legislature, this man was my seatmate. And I didn't really know what he was going through with his daughter, but his daughter, they had placed her in a variety of schools and even in hospitals. She had some form of mental illness, and finally she recovered from that and was a college student. She looks quite good here, but here you probably have gone through some difficulties with your children, or perhaps you've had financial reversal. Sometimes people bet their life savings and find out that they've been swindled or taken advantage of, or perhaps you've been laid off from your job. And so that's another thing. And, of course, there's the issue of divorce, where marriage, for some reason, goes on the rocks. And so all of these things, how do we cope with these kinds of adversities? And I'm sure if I were to go around the room, each of you could tell a little bit about your particular issue. Well, I think there are several ways to deal with it, but let me start first with acceptance. This passage you're all perhaps familiar with, Paul had a thorn in the flesh. He said, "It was given to me a messenger of Satan to keep me from being too elated. Three times I appealed to the Lord about this, that it would leave me. But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness.'" Now, Paul didn't choose to identify what that thorn in the flesh was. Some assume that maybe it was an eye problem, because in the Galatian letter he does write and say, "I'm writing in such large letters with my own hands." I don't know what it was, but some way, somehow, Paul had to accept it. And that simply points out to us that in all of our trouble, if we're Christians, we believe that God is with us. And of course, that's why the 23rd Psalm is such a wonderful passage. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul." And then he goes on later to say, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." And that's true in the Old Testament. There's a passage in Lamentations that's very striking. Here, this writer of Lamentations, Jerusalem was laid waste. He was describing it in great detail. His heart was broken. But then he said, "Great is thy faithfulness." And he said, in other words, God is with me. And he can see me through this particular pain. And friends can be of great help. Here's a passage that our a song that I thought I would refer to. "How firm a foundation, when through the deep waters cause you to go, the rivers of sorrow shall not overflow, for I will be with thee, thy troubles to bless, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress. When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace all sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee, I only design thy dross to consume, and thy gold to refine." And then, of course, friends mean a lot. I remember when Adam passed away, we had wonderful friends that came to our home. They fulfilled that passage of weep with those that weep. They were with us night and day. And particularly sometimes you can turn to people who have gone through the same thing. We had a friend whose daughter had been murdered some years before. And he came to our home, and we talked to him about his recovery from that tragedy in his own life. And he said, you know, we kind of asked him naturally, "Well, we're going to have joy again," because it seemed not possible at that time. He said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Joy and sorrow are two different streams." And he said, "Yes, you'll have sorrow, but," he said, "there'll be joy in your life." And that was very prophetic, what he told us. And so friends can be helpful, and sometimes counseling can help. We went to a grief counselor, and somebody who's experienced a counselor can be of great help. So we deal with adversity in a variety of ways, but I have to tell you that one of the ways you can deal with adversity is you can deal with adversity by being active. You finally have to sort of pick up and say, "I'm going on. I've got things I've got to do." We were the parents of five children, and so I naturally thought, as Lucretia did, you know, we can't simply be so tied up in the grief over our son that we aren't a parent to the other four children. They're depending on us. We all had work to do. We talked yesterday about how that in old age you have opportunities for service. Well, there are times when you have to go ahead and serve. God still expects you to serve. Sometimes, will you be discouraged? Of course. I think of old Elijah when he had had that battle with the prophets of Baal and had defeated them, and he thought things were so good. Now Jehovah is in supreme. And then suddenly he gets word from Jezebel. She says, you know what happened to those prophets? It's going to happen to you. We're coming after you. And he goes into a cave and he's very much in despair. Said, I'm the only one left, Lord. God said, wait a minute. There's 7,000 people that haven't bowed their knee to Baal yet. And I've got work for you to do. I've got some things that need to be done. And so in his despondency, he was lifted up. So there's a therapeutic value of being active after grief or in old age. There's some things that we ought to be involved in doing and changing life. I know Lucretia, at the time of Adam's death, she was teaching English. And so she often would, as she taught those students, she'd think, well, Adam's not here, but I can do something for these students. And it was then in 1996, I ended up being elected to the legislature. And I was a voice for gun safety because of the tragedy in my own life. I thought, I can't save Adam, but I can save other people. I can make sure that guns are stored safely in homes and take some other steps. So there are ways in which we can step forward. And finally, an example that I want to cite is, here's one. Connie Smith, at age 91, after being widowed at age 74, she said, one of the many things I've learned from my sad times was that if you could keep your body active enough to get really tired, you didn't have time to feel sorry for yourself. Well, that's pretty good advice. You got to keep going and moving. And she had a great spirit. She only passed away a few weeks ago. And here was a woman that just, you know, in her mid-90s, she was still active and on fire and doing good. And now I go to history and tell the story of one of the people that was one of the outstanding presidents of the United States. Most historians would list FDR as perhaps one of our five greatest presidents.
That's right.
And, you know, he was somebody who was a vice presidential nominee in 1920, but a year later something happened in his life. He was smitten with polio. And he never really walked after that. Sometime if you go back in those history books, you'll see pictures of him, but he was always sitting down. And when he was standing, and often in a wheelchair, but when he was standing up, he had to grasp a lectern with both hands. In fact, his son and somebody else had helped him walk up there, and he had braces on his legs. And I remember, well, I was talking to one of his sons one time, and he told about his father one time. He said he was backstage and said we had failed to lock those braces, and he fell flat on his face, and his speech went everywhere, and said he didn't even, he said he picked us up, he said pretty angry, he said that we hadn't locked his braces. He said he got all those pages together, and he couldn't put them back together. He said he made a great speech, but he didn't have his speech in order anymore. So here he went through, of course, the Depression, could stand up in front of the American people and say, we have nothing to fear but fear itself, and yeah, went through World War II. So here is how recovery. So you'll go through adversity. Certainly there are some things that are typical of older age, but I believe we can go through that. Paul one time said, I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor anything else in all creation shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. And now I'll let you handle these tricky matters of relationships, Lucretia.
Sure. I want to applaud you, because that was really good.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay, the complexities of family relationships. I'm not going to talk to you about normal complexities. I mean, when our oldest daughter, who's now a wonderful person, and we spent the night with her last night, was about 15, I reduced myself to being on her bed and crying and saying, I'm a good person. A lot of people like me. Why don't you like me? You know? And then we had five kids. And we had the three daughters and all of them. turned against me at certain ages. I think that's a natural thing. And those of you who had, but I'm not going to talk about that because that's more appropriate for someone who's in a teenage, how to raise teenagers, you know. That's not our problem now. Nor am I going to talk to you about deep social problems, deep problems, because you'll need to go to therapists for those. And some of you have had those, but for instance, we saw on TV a man whose son had turned against him and slashed his face, and he was all scarred, and the son later committed suicide, or drug problems, or whatever. Those are serious problems, and you need to do something about that. Nor am I going to talk about the professional help that's needed for someone like Steinberg and his daughter that Jack talked about. I'm just going to talk about common family problems. Okay, this is a tricky assignment. Why? Because family relationships matter. And, you know, we're not happy when our family's not happy. What was it Jack said that you often quote, you said that you're only as happy as your most unhappy kid. And that lasts all your life. Okay. Because it takes two to tango, or even more to mess up a family. Because each family is different and each has its own dynamic. Okay, so I'm not tackling the serious problems, I'm just tackling the minor problems that we have in the family. The greatest commandment is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There's no other commandment greater than these. Well, it's very hard to love anybody, especially in the family, like ourselves, because we love ourselves a lot, and especially if we're angry with the person. We get to the answer of the problem of relationships in Romans. It says, live in harmony with one another, repay no one evil for evil. If possible, so far as depends on you, live peaceably with all. And that applies to churches, to families, to everything. It's, you sometimes take things so personal, and you shouldn't take them personally. So work for peaceful relationships. How? Well, for one thing, don't ever nag. Either your friends or your family or anything. But nobody in here thinks they nag, right? Because nagging says, do it or do it now. I had an aunt who was a real nagger. And my grandmother, that I adored, was a real nagger. But have you ever been changed by someone nagging you? Have you ever changed anybody by nagging them? So don't nag. Now, there's the overt form of nagging, but there's a subtle form of nagging, too. You can say, you said you were going to do that, but when are you going to get around to doing that? You know, that's nagging. Do you intend to do such and so, or when are you going to do so and so? You know, that's nagging. And whether you realize it or not, it is nagging, and sometimes it builds a resistance in people. It sounds so polite, but be for sure, it's nagging. Letter from a man in a foxhole. He wrote his wife. He said, don't send no more nagging letters. It don't do no good. He said, let me enjoy this war. So let's don't nag people. Let's live peaceably with all, as the Bible commands us to do. But apparently that's hard, because if you read advice columns like Jack and I do, every day there's a mother and particularly mothers and brides, you know, there's an argument about how the guest list and everything. And then there's an argument between husband and wife, and between brothers and sisters, and between in-laws and mother-in-laws, and you know, it goes on and on and on. Neighbors, just don't do it. How can we avoid the situations? Well, zip the lip. And I really mean quit talking so much. Start listening. It's very hard for us because we've lived so much we think we know what to do. For example, when my girls then grew up and had daughters of their own, and their daughters turned into teenagers. I didn't say, I told you so. Look, see how it feels. I didn't say that. I zipped the lip. So don't be guilty of that. Now, our grandson and his wife lived with us for nearly 5 years, and they had little children while they were living with us. And Jack and I made a pact that we would not discuss that, one thing, we'd just be ourselves. And so, but we wouldn't ever criticize them for either how they related to each other, they related very well, or how they were as parents. At the table, they were very strict. And they'd sometimes get after the kids. And we'd just look down at our plates and not say a word. So zip your lip.
Unless they ask.
Unless they ask.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's none of your business how your kids raise their kids. It's not your business how they do it. They may do it differently from you. They may have different sleep times. They may send them to different kind of schools. It's none of your business. It's their business. And they'll have to take the consequences, whatever it is. Now, never, ever correct adult children. I'm an English teacher. So I corrected grammar all the time. But I made a promise to myself that after they graduated from high school, I wouldn't correct them anymore. And I didn't. They still make grammatical mistakes, and I don't like that. But I zipped my lip. All right. The reason that you don't correct adult children is they'll take it another way. They'll say, and that was the joy of living with our grandson. Instead of, this is a wonderful time to be grandparents because I hadn't told Paul to take out the trash when he was a kid. So when I said to him, Paul, the trash needs to be taken out, you know, I wasn't my daughter who fussed at him and said, you need to take out that trash now, Paul, or else, you know, because it's easier. So they will take it another way. Your kids are very sensitive. Tend your own knitting. What does that mean? That means mind your own business. Getting along with others, and that's in the church or where or with the neighborhood, just tend your own lawn. Tend your own knitting. Mind your own business. All right. It never does any good to meddle in another's affairs. If somebody meddles in your affairs, you automatically think they don't know the whole situation. You know, I know better than they do. And I remember with our children, when my father and Jack's dad, particularly the mothers, were better about not saying anything, but they'd say things. I didn't like it because I think you don't know these kids like I do. So it doesn't matter whether you're right or you're wrong. Mind your own business. Now, you can be so stubborn. I want to tell you about a family member that's so stubborn, she doesn't even know her, they don't even know their grandchildren. Because they have cut off their son because he lives with a woman they don't like, they don't respect her, and they have two children, she doesn't even know them, they have no relationship with them at all. So sometimes the old people can be really stubborn. All right. But sometimes the young people can be stubborn too. Another family I know, the girl was so stubborn and the mother and dad were so willing to help her out. The Whitsons. They never gave up. They lit a candle every night and prayed for her. She failed to come to her father when he was very ill. She didn't even come to her dad's funeral. Patsy still hung in there. And now, even though her father died without not knowing it, she has seen her daughter, and they're close again. She calls nearly every day to see how see how her mother is. So you just hang in, and maybe after you die that something happens. Never give up. Painful memories. Okay, we all have painful memories. You can remember, you can be mad at your parents for how they treated you. But if you think about it, I've got grandchildren older than my dad was when I was a little girl. And so consider what age they were. And then consider what they were going through. Consider their lives. And you may not know that your neighbor is going through deep depression or whatever, or someone at church is, but just consider their lives. Do your best to let the past be the past. But you do need to understand why you were hurt and what hurt you, and maybe do that, but be sure you do this. Now, I want to talk to you some about this, because I learned this lesson so much with Adam when he died. Jax talked about that. Do not go to a funeral with regret. Don't stand over a casket. Do not stand over a casket feeling you did not do everything in your power to make things right, because that's going to make you feel really bad. I was lucky because Adam and I had everything clear between us. And so the only regret I could think of is I didn't send him flowers on his first day at his new job. But that's not much, you know. But he was good to me. I was good to him. And we didn't have regret. We've talked about it. And so don't, Jack has told you about his Adam death, don't stand over a casket feeling you didn't do everything to make things right. You want to be sure you do that. Do recall how suddenly someone can die. Unexpected. And nothing can prevent that from happening to you. You can't have enough money, you can't have enough status in the community or anything. It can happen to everybody. And so you need to keep it clear with everybody right now. And like I told my daughter when she was 15, I said, everybody likes me. I'm a good person, you know. But she got over it. She's fine now. Whatever position you're in, the Bible says, if possible, so far as it is within you, so far as it depends upon you, live peaceably with all. And that means in the church and in your neighborhood and everything. If possible, don't let estrangement be a part of your life. Please don't let estrangement be a part of your life. If you need to take care of it today, because the person you're estranged from may be dead tomorrow. Anyway, I'm sure we have a lot of things to discuss, like he said, unless they ask for it. So that we'll open up the discussion now.
Sure. Okay. We are ready for comments, ready for questions, ready for disagreements.
Anything you want to do.
Come ahead. Yes, sir.
A big thing I would think would be estate planning. So many folks, when they don't take care of the legal matters of going old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's
they
a good
don't.
Point. For, and you know, there's a lot of things connected with old age. You know, everything with nutrition, exercise, and estate planning. We have made a will, and we know exactly the way, and we're making even arrangements now to make sure that our funeral arrangements are done so that when we pass away, that our children won't have to immediately go in and make all those kind of arrangements. So estate planning is important. Other questions? Yes, Barbara.
I just want to say my brother was killed in a plane crash in 1981. And the brother, just younger than he, a month or so later, said to me, you know, it seems like our parents don't have any other children. They don't consider that they have any other children. Yeah. And I had thought that, but he voiced it.
He voiced it.
And
he said,
I had to agree with him, but I understood that was part of the grieving process, too.
It was, but the sisters and brothers grieved it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then in regards to giving advice, I tell my kids I don't give advice if they call me. But I say, if it were me, this is what I would do.
No, only if they call you.
Only if they
only
call
if they
me.
Ask.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. What else did you want to mention? Something else that
On your mind, yes.
I just want to broaden that question out a little bit more. What are the conditions under which you can say something to your kids or advise your kids? Sometimes they're not asking you, but you know they need some help. When can you step in? What are the cues?
Well,
well, when they're teenagers, you can.
Well, number one, let's say you normally your influence over your children is gauged when they're in your house. The influence after they leave your house is not too much. Now, if they ask for advice, and, you know, they come to you, maybe you are good at finances and they ask you for financial advice. Or maybe they're dealing with a serious problem at work and you had 20 years of work. I was a president of a college, and so my son and I talked a little bit about administration and how to deal with people. And we talked about it more in general. I think there might be some rare instances when you really think their safety is at risk that you might step in and say,
right.
You know, people have intervened, for instance, in the case of someone who's an alcoholic, where that maybe, and normally they do that with a whole family. They don't just one person, but they, you remember the famous case of Betty Ford when her children and her husband determined that she was addicted. And so they all met with her and actually intervened. So there's some rare cases, but I guess what we're trying to say is most of the time, and you get unsolicited advice, which creates resentment rather than creating positive feelings. I know Lucretia was, there was a couple that was moving to a certain city, and the mother-in-law decided to tell them what church they ought to go to. Now, well, you can imagine that really went over big.
And
so, you know, that kind of thing. I'm just saying.
Here's an example. This is a big one. Your daughter is about to engage in a serious relationship with a man you know is going to be nothing but trouble for the rest of her life.
Okay, let me tell you the problem with that. Most of the time, that drives her in, that encourages her to take up that relationship. Because she's completely in love with this person now, and she sees him in a way that you don't see him. And so you tell her that, and so she's suddenly thinking, well, number one, you know, how many times have you known that this made it very difficult then once a marriage occurred, for there to be a lot of communication. So I'd be awfully careful about that. And it'd be sometime better if somebody outside the family, because really, a lot of times, the very fact that, you know, it's kind of reverse psychology. Go ahead, Lucretia.
Well, you could be wrong, you know. I mean, we've been wrong before about when the kids got married. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you that often it doesn't do any good. Yeah.
Can you recruit somebody to go in and talk for you?
I can. But she'll just turn against the other person. Or he will.
That's yes.
Tricky.
Yeah. Very tricky, yes.
And sometimes I think we cause our own problems with our children because in the way we do things, we encourage our children to get an education and go to the university and go on with your life, and we encourage this independence, and once they do that, they fly away. They're gone. They're away from house, they're away from everything, and they don't have that connection to mom and dad anymore. And we've encouraged that to go away. And I think that's a sad thing in one sense. Yes, okay, now they're independent, they're wonderful adults and everything else, but what happened to family?
Yeah, but let me say something here. I think in the long run, if I love my child, I am going to want what's best for my child, not what's best for me. And, you know, I moved from Texas to New Haven. Now, that meant that I was 2,500 miles away from my parents and her parents, but we went and preached for a church in New Haven, Connecticut, where we thought we ought to be, and I was able to pursue my education and so forth. I think if you really love your children, you really love what it is they choose to do. For instance, a lot of parents have difficulty in terms of their children doing mission work because they're going to be in Africa or they're going to be in Mexico or they're going to be in some other place. Wait a minute. What's most important here? It's not how you feel. It's what's best for them. And in this case, what's maybe best for the Lord's work. But, you know, we're all selfish a little bit. And so, you know, we cripple our children sometime by the fact that we don't want them to be independent.
Well, and then, but it doesn't mean you're not going to suffer, because you're going to suffer. When we called Jack's mother, we thought we were moving back from New Haven to Oklahoma, but we came to California instead. And she went to bed and pulled the covers over her head and cried for a few hours, you know.
But she didn't say anything to us.
She didn't say anything to us. We found that out later. So that's good. That's good. But, I mean, it's going to hurt, and it hurts. If you see someone who's drug addicted or alcohol addicted, it has to be really serious before you interfere, because it doesn't work. It won't work. Yeah.
You know, just pray about it.
Pray about it. That's good.
If God is faithful and will hear your prayer. There's a reading by Max Lucado who says, people don't realize how the prayers of parents when their children are very young, God could answer when they get older. And I think that's so true.
It's tough being our age because we know better. We know better. We know what they should do. Mm-hmm. Or we think we do. Yeah.
Well, I agree with everything you both said. I have two sons, and they're both in their 40s, and we've been through some stuff, and some of it I was involved in. So what I learned was to let go and let God.
Let go and let God.
A lot of that is, I think, part of your relationship with the Lord is your obligation to let it go. But the other thing, my children occasionally will ask for advice, and I always have to be careful even then, I think. Careful even then what I say. So what's worked for me is to say I can only respond based on my experience, and then I tell them a story. If it's something that they're asking me about, I'll say, like, for example, this happened, blah, 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 because now they have kids. Mm-hmm. And then I always make sure they understand that I can only advise you based or give you an answer based on my experience. So they that's really the only, that's where it's coming from.
That's a great response because, number one, it admits your fallibility.
Exactly.
If you come at anybody, I don't care who you're advising, if you come at it like a know-it-all,
right.
That's not generally something that people accept very well. If you come at it with the fact, I'm hesitant to say this, but let me think. I'll tell you a little bit about my experience, and maybe I'd lean a little bit in this direction, but I know your circumstances might be, if you have all of those qualifiers in there, but if you just come along and say, if I were you, I'd do so-and-so and so-and-so, then right away, you know, you've got a lot of resistance going on there. And I really do think that the first thing you got to think about is if you love a child or you love anybody, your first thing you think is not what's good for me, but what's good for that person. And that sometimes all of a sudden reorients your thinking a little bit. You know, it's like, you know, sometimes you see fathers who almost demand that their son take over the family business or do what he did. And you want to say, wait a minute, that's another individual. That's not you. That's another individual. And maybe the fact that you were a farmer doesn't appeal to him at all. He wants to be an artist, or he wants to do something else.
Or like our son-in-law, Paul.
Yeah.
He was a fisherman.
Yeah, he was a fisherman, and I was a professional man. So,
but his sons, he was really good about that. His sons didn't want to fish. And so he had three grown sons, and one of them came to live with us because he wanted to be a chiropractor, and none of the three boys wanted to fish, even though it had been in the family for many generations. But Paul was good about it. He just let him go.
Other comments. We got about 2 minutes, so before I know you have it. Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say what I've seen, because I'm the youngest, I'm the sixth out of seven children, so I kind of watch my parents kind of grow as parents. Like, I saw them dealing with the teenage years and all that stuff as I was growing up. And I've seen, like, my dad especially going through, like, a whole, oh, you have to do this. And he's like, an extremist. So he's always, you have to do this. You got to do this. And I've noticed over the years, like, with me, doesn't do that anymore.
That's because he doesn't love
you. Right? I know. Yeah, no. Now that I'm an adult, he doesn't take the approach of, like, you have to do this. You have to do this. It's like, instead, he kind of watches what I do, and then always now is like, I'm always here, and I always love you. And so now I go to them for advice all the time. I call my mom every day. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like, just like you're right about, you know, don't push, don't say, you gotta do this, don't do that, you know, but just say, I love you, and I'm here, mm-hmm. you know, and they'll always gravitate back to you because you always gravitate towards people who love you.
That's right.
So. That's mm-hmm. Now here's a testimony from a child. So that's a great testimony. And those of us who are older can listen to that because that's the first thing about, you know, about most anything. When people sense that you love them and you really care about them and you do care deeply about your children or about other people. But the first thing they've got to do is establish that relationship about love. Then a lot of other things follow. Karina, what else do you want to say?
Well, I was just going to say that thank you for that comment because it's really hard when you know better and you can tell the kids, don't do that. I mean, it's hard as a grandparent to see your kids raise it. We had the fortunate thing of seeing one daughter raise her kids, and she was real lenient. She didn't do anything. And we would say, those kids need to be spanked behind their back. We don't talk to them. We talk behind their back. Which is, and then the other daughter was too strict, we thought. She spanked too much. And they were, but the kids turned out fine. You know, so, but we didn't say anything, did we? No. We're perfect, of course.
Anything else? So we'll have to
yes, sir. Just one thing. Kudos to that last comment, by the way. Great. You're standing over the grave, right? Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to express regrets. You mentioned that. But there's something you could have told your child that you didn't tell your child because you didn't want to interfere in their life, but could have changed their course. Uh-huh.
So it wouldn't
help. There are times when you need to step in. It's just the problem becomes, when is that, and what exactly do you say? You said a lot of qualifiers. I agree with that. You have to qualify what you're saying five different ways from Sunday. But there are times when you got to step in to avoid that regretful situation over the casket. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it is tough, and I'm not. We're not saying there's never any time, but I'm saying we sin way too much on the side of talking of wanting to take charge of somebody else's life, and you can't do that. And if you did, I've seen parents that were so domineering that they took charge of somebody's life. And that life didn't turn out very well. You know, they just were somebody who couldn't, or else they took charge and for maybe 10, 15 years, the child took it. And then one day there was that explosion of rebellion. And I mean, they went to the other extreme and they said, I've had it with you. And then that's a bad situation. So I don't know. I don't think there's a more difficult job in life than parenting.
Yes.
So you might as well accept that. You're going to be a parent the rest of your life.
And sometimes,
old age is not for sissies.
Sometimes your kids may be wanting to give you unsolicited advice.
Oh, yeah. They do.
Oh, of course. Yes. And you can always smile and say thank you. And then do what you want to do. Okay, thank you for coming. Good turnout.